we're halfway through the retreat. It is amazing, isn't it? Gone quite quickly, huh? Very quickly. And you'll find that the second half will go even quicker. And it will be finished like in a minute now. And then you'll go, what happened? So I think at the end of our life, when we die, it's like that too. You know? All of a sudden, it's time to die, and you look back, and where did it go? And so it really becomes like a flash of lightning and a finger snap. So while we have the opportunity, you know, each moment is a very precious moment to live with a precious in our life. Extremely precious. And very difficult to get this opportunity. And you know, think about karma. Karma we've created even in this lifetime, you know. To get the kind of opportunity that we have in the future. It's hard. So while we have it, it's very important to really use it wisely, you know, because samsara is big and vast, and when this opportunity is gone, we don't know what situation we're going to be faced with. You know, when you think about it, it's like each moment is a very precious moment like that. And then you think how often we space out, you know, how often we're going from point A to point B, and we're not paying attention as we're walking, because our mind is already at point B, or it's already somewhere else in the universe, you know. So here we are, kind of living our life, going moment by moment, but we're never really there. Now, or we're talking to one person and we're thinking about something else we have to do, or we're doing one thing but we're actually thinking, oh, I should be doing something else. So the mind is never quite present with what's going on. I saw, and your things are quite interesting. I didn't put mine up yet. I only had I didn't have a big piece of paper. Mine was most of the wall. it corresponds to how busy your mind is. So, you know, somebody had mentioned about another thing about learning about mindfulness. And I think mindfulness has many different meanings, you know, especially as Buddhism's coming to the West. Mindfulness is being used all different sorts of which ways. But in the traditional usage, it means being, if you're meditating, being aware, being mindful, remembering your object of meditation, and during the break time, during your life, being mindful of precepts, being mindful of renunciation, of bodhicitta, of wisdom. In other words, holding in your mind the things that you know are true and valid, and living from them. And so each moment that we live is an opportunity to be mindful, to be fully present in that moment that we're living. And not just fully present in the way of, oh yes, I'm mindful attachment is arising. Oh yes, I'm mindful I'm telling someone off. You know, excuse me, not like that. Okay? That's why I said mindfulness is very often used in any which way in America. But each moment is really an opportunity to be mindful of some aspect of the Dharma and really live the Dharma in that moment. So whether you're on the cushion or off the cushion. If you're on the cushion, you know, when you're sitting there, when you're doing the refuge prayer, to actually be thinking about what you're saying. Yeah. Now often when we do the practice many times, we stop thinking about what we're saying And we say, I know this already, let's think about something more interesting, like, what are we having for lunch? Or, you know, some other thing. We get distracted. But mindfulness, really being aware, like when you're doing the sadhana, of what the meaning is to each part that you're saying, really being there with it. Okay? When you're visualizing Vajrasattva, who's your object of meditation, you know, remembering Vajrasattva in your mind, remembering your object of meditation, not forgetting it. Or if you're reciting the mantra, you know, being mindful of the vibration of the mantra, if you're switching your object from the visualized one to, you're making it, you still have the visualized one, but you're making it more the auditory one, more the mantra vibration, then really being there with the mantra 100%. Okay? So whatever acting you're doing in the sadhana, really being there with it. Okay, when you're offering, you're making offering, you're not thinking about the next step of making the request or, you know, making confession or whatever it is. Yeah, when you're going through your daily life activities, you know, being mindful of your precepts, how your precepts pertain to each situation you're in. Whether you have the five lay precepts, bodhisattva precepts, tantric precepts, being mindful of those precepts, holding them in mind in each situation you encounter. Yeah. Or what you might do is each day be mindful of a particular Lamrim meditation and encounter and see everything in terms of that Lamrim meditation. So maybe one day it's mindfulness of precious human life. So everything you relate to, it's from that view. Or another day, maybe it's mindfulness of impermanence and death, so it's relating to everything from that view. Or maybe another day it's bodhicitta, or it's refuge. Okay? So you relate to everything you encounter, whether you're eating or washing the dishes or vacuuming the floor or taking a walk or shoveling snow or whatever, through the eyes of that particular meditation. Okay? Emptiness is a good one, you know, everything you're looking at, it's merely, it's just by being merely labeled, it doesn't have its own substantial nature. Okay? So mindfulness means holding in the mind, holding the Dharma in the mind, yeah, and being aware of what you're doing through that means. It doesn't mean just when you're on the cushion, it also means on the break time, okay? So, like I've noticed this last week, the people who are bringing my food are being much more mindful. You know, I think when they're opening the door, they're being more aware of opening the door and putting the food down and making offering and closing the door and so on. You know, because the whole opening and closing of the door has changed 180 degrees from the previous week. You know, so that's indicating that there's some mindfulness going on there. So, you know, being aware also when you enter and leave the house here, how are you opening and closing the door? Is it with compassion for the other people you're living with? You know, and that's why I talk a lot about being mindful of how you're moving through space. Yeah? And when you're using the bathroom, are you mindful of compassion, and so how you're leaving the bathroom? Are you leaving it clean for the next person who comes? Yeah. So all these kinds of things are ways of integrating the Dharma into what we're doing and being present with a Dharma mind with whatever we're doing. Okay? So this is the meaning of mindfulness. If you think that there's no mindfulness taught in the Tibetan tradition because we don't say the word mindfulness, mindfulness, mindfulness all the time, so you think you need to go somewhere else to learn mindfulness, then be more mindful of of the teachings and, you know, and try and hold them in mind. Yeah. That's one thing I was thinking about this week. I just wanted to also check in with you about how the discipline of the retreat is going. Is the silence going okay?
Pato had to encourage us once again that this is a very precious time and that we should really, go even a little bit, try even harder.
Yeah, that's good. Instead of talking with your mouth, are you writing a lot of notes? Is there a proliferation of note writing? So just be, mindful and attentive of, sometimes when the mouth doesn't move, then, I have to write some, I have to tell this person this, and I have to tell this person, I have to tell this person, and I have to put this, that, and the other thing on the shopping list, and I have to, this, that, and the other thing. So, really trying to rein in the mind. It's interesting when you have the idea, I really need to get this. Don't write the note immediately. Wait one day. And if the next day you still feel you need it and you're remembering it, then you write the note. But it could be that, the mind has this, I definitely need this. Then maybe you don't. Maybe take a day and just come back to it. See if your mind comes to it the next day as something that you need. Even if it's something like long rim outlines or whatever. When I learned the Dharma, we didn't have photocopy machines in India. We wrote out all the outlines ourselves. And you know what? That way we learned them. Because we had to take out a book and, make the outline ourselves and think about it and learn the points and stuff like that. So lots of times, rather than just saying, I need this photocopy, this, take some time to write it out and see if that helps you learn it and remember it better. Okay, then some of the inmates wrote questions, so I thought to start with those. Oh, and also just to say that I received a totally amazing letter from an inmate I've never heard from. I gave the letter to Flora, so some of you... Do you have that same feeling about that letter? Oh, you've all read it? I couldn't talk after I read it. I just sat there. No, but I couldn't write back to him. It's like I was just so floored. I found it so incredibly moving. So moving. So, he's no different than all of us. In terms of how stuck the mind can get and how just a little bit of Dharma can free the mind from a 800-pound gorilla. I'm sure I didn't end with that. So when you're finished with the letter, then return it. I'll try to answer it. It's just flabbergasted. Okay, so one of the questions about the Buddha having negative karma, because in the Pali Canon there's some sutras about, like, the Buddha had stepped on a shard of stone and was in great pain, or he ate a meal with bad food in it and got quite sick. And so he was saying, but Buddha's enlightened and suffering is supposed to come from negative karma, so how come the Buddha is experiencing this suffering? So there's two different ways in which the Buddha is seen, according to whether you're looking at the Pali tradition or the Sanskrit tradition. In the Pali tradition, the Buddha is seen as an ordinary being when he was born, and in this lifetime he went from the first path of accumulation, to the fifth path of no more learning, attained enlightenment, and then and he still had this body, contaminated body that was born due to afflictions and karma. And then they say that when he attained Mahaparinirvana at the end of his life, that then, because he was enlightened, his consciousness ceased, and that's it. Okay? So according to that view of the Buddha, then it looks like, yes, the Buddha steps on stone, and, you know, he experiences pain, or he gets a stomach ache from bad food, or whatever. Okay? From the Mahayana viewpoint, yeah, the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, is an emanation of the omniscient mind of all of the Buddhas. Okay? So Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, was actually enlightened a long time ago and appeared on this earth in the form of an ordinary being and went through, you know, growing up and doing all the whole thing and, you know, the whole appearing to, you know, renounce and appearing to attain enlightenment and going through all of that. He did that, although he was already enlightened, in order to show us an example of what we need to do and how we need to practice. Okay, so it was a skillful way to show us. So when the Buddha, you know, when it looked like the Buddha was experiencing pain because he stepped on the shard of stone, he wasn't really experiencing pain. It was a skill, manifesting that way in a skillful way to encourage the disciples to be free of a body born of afflictions and karma, because that body is painful. Okay? So, so there's different ways to see the Buddha, whether you're seeing him as an ordinary being who attained enlightenment in this lifetime 2,500 years ago, or seeing him as an emanation of all of the omniscient minds of the Buddhas appearing in that skillful aspect. Okay? Also, in the Mahayana path, when they talk about, even before you get to Buddhahood, by the path of seeing, you're not experiencing physical pain in that way because of the accumulation of merit that you have and because of your understanding of emptiness. Okay? And so in that way, you know, it looks like there's pain going on, but it's not really that way. Like in the story, you know, of the Buddha in a previous life before he was enlightened, when he was the Bodhisattva prince and taking the walk in the forest and saw the tigress and her starving cubs. You know that story? And so the cubs were starving and the tigress was starving. She had no food. She couldn't feed her cubs. They were all going to die. So the Bodhisattva prince thought, I will just give my body to the tigress. She can eat it. And then, you know, her cubs can nurse and they'll all live. And so very happily he gave his body for her to have lunch. And he didn't experience any pain doing that because of the depth of his realization of emptiness. Because of the profundity of his bodhicitta. Okay? So us ordinary beings aren't at that level yet. But, you know, if you ever meet a bear or a cougar in the woods, it's a good way to think. Yeah. Okay, so the Buddha doesn't actually experience that kind of physical suffering. It's an appearance done for our sake. But there are these two ways of viewing the Buddha. And it's not like you have to choose one way or another. I find it personally in my own practice, I use both ways of using the Buddha depending upon what's going on in my practice. I remember so vividly when I was in Taiwan taking the Bhikshuni precepts, in the temple they had the 12 deeds of the Buddha, these big kind of it was out of metal. What do they call it when they make like a bas relief out of metal or something? But all around the outside and inside of the temple, you have the scenes from the Buddha's life. So at lunchtime, I would circumambulate. And it was kind of like a meditation, you know? thinking about all these different things that the Buddha did, and, you know, getting born and going to school and, you know, renouncing, and, you know, the whole scene with the swan and all those different things, and seeing the Buddha as an ordinary being and what he really had to do, and what he, the effort and hard energy he had to put into to gain the realizations he did. And I found it very, very inspiring to contemplate the Buddha as an ordinary being while I was walking around, because it gave me a lot of inspiration and energy for my own practice. At other times, it's helpful to think of the Buddha as, you know, a manifestation of the omniscient mind. But, you know, so you don't have to choose one way or another. You do whatever, you view the Buddha from whichever way you need to at a specific time. Okay? Then also had the question that, do you keep purifying something if you feel like it's been purified already? Okay? Now, I think it's always good when we're doing purification to say all of my negative karmas that I've ever confessed from I've ever done since beginningless time, I'm confessing and purifying all of them, and in particular, da 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 da, maybe some that we want to really work on. So we might work on some for a while, feel like we've come to some peace about them, and feel like we're ready to move on to make some other ones the main focus of our meditation. But it's still good all the time to continuously say, and I'm still purifying and confessing that one before too, because we include it in the whole category of all the negative karma that I've ever created. Okay, so in that way, we're continuing to chip away at it, even though we've made peace with it. The thing is, and I might have mentioned this before, is that I've noticed in my own experience, I'll feel like something's been purified and settled, and that's good, and 1 and 2 years later, there it is again, but at a different level, with a different emphasis, a different accent. And so I need to go back to it again, and I'm ready at that time to purify it in a deeper level and make peace with it at a deeper level. Okay? So I have found in my practice that it's always wise to remain humble and never say, oh, I've purified that, I'm never going to do that one again. Or I've taken care of that defilement, I'm free of that one. You know, because as soon as we do that, whammo, a situation arises in our life or something comes up in our meditation and we're back at square one. So I think it's always much more helpful to think, I've accomplished some purification on that one, but actually until I'm at the path of seeing, I haven't completely purified it. So I've got to still remain attentive, you know, and not get arrogant or complacent or smug. Okay? It doesn't mean that you don't trust yourself. You do trust yourself, but you don't trust your negativities. Okay? Okay. Then, I had a reflection. And he was saying, I'll read you from this. He was saying that he always finds something in each Q&A session, because he did the retreat last year, that somebody brings up something that really pertains to him. Mm-hmm. So he's very grateful for all the things that your people bring up. So he said here, in the Q&A session, someone mentioned about the meditation becoming mechanical. I feel that way sometimes, but even when it feels that way, I feel like it is still good for me, because I think I am at least creating some continuum in my meditation. It is easy for me to say, well, this is not going too good, I'll do it tomorrow, and get up and do something else. So even if it's mechanical from boredom, or because my mind is on fast forward, and I feel, even though if it's mechanical from boredom, or because my mind is on fast forward, I still feel that I am making a habit of sitting. Also, I have been trying to solely do the Vajrasattva practice, but it seems like some others are doing different meditation at the same time. If my mind wanders when I catch it, I just try to direct it back to the mantra. But some of the retreatants seem to be contemplating their thoughts and such. Are they pausing the Vajrasattva practice to deal with what is arising? Or are they doing the contemplating, visualizing, and mantra all at once? Actually, technically speaking, you know, what he's doing is really very good. You know, when your mind gets distracted from the visualization and the mantra, you bring your mind right back to Vajrasattva and your mantra. Okay. Now, we all know that sometimes when we do that, within half a mantra, the mind's off again because something has come up quite strong in our mind, and we really feel like, I need to look at it now, because if I don't look at it now, the energy isn't going to be there. Do you know what I mean? It's like somehow something's coming clear in your mind at that moment, and you know if you don't really resolve it or look at it, then it's, you're not going to be able to come back to it. So in that case, then you need to switch and focus on whatever that thing is that's coming up at that particular time. Okay, if what's coming up isn't very strong and you put yourself back on Vajrasattva, stay with Vajrasattva, okay? But if it's like something powerful that you really need to look at, or maybe it's some powerful feeling about some aspect of the Lam Rim, you know, that is really coming true for you in that moment, then I think it's good to really switch the majority of our attention to what that thing is. You can still keep the visualization or the mantra kind of going on in the background if you want to, and then switch to what it is that you need to deal with. Or if what's coming up is really big, you can just pause the mantra and the visualization, deal with what you need to, and then go back to Vajrasattva. Depends on you and how you can do it. In terms of doing the Lam Rim meditation, you know, I think that is fine to do while you're doing the mantra and all. When your mind is kind of getting bored, or when it's getting, you feel like the meditation's getting quite mechanical, then to kind of spruce it up or juice it up, you know, if you do some Lam Rim meditation, and you can think that while you're purifying, what, you know, you're still doing Vajrasattva, but you think what you're purifying while you're thinking about Lam Rim is the obscuration to gaining the realization of that Lam Rim meditation. Okay? Or you can think that while you're contemplating that aspect of Lam Rim, you know, one of the analytic meditations on the gradual path to enlightenment, think that the nectar is the realization of that meditation subject, so that while you're contemplating that, that nectar is filling you up, you know, with the realization of what you're contemplating. Okay? I think those are quite good questions. Then, okay, he said, the Vajrasattva retreat has been, well, it's been. The visualization practice is eluding me. It's improving. But the melting images and mantra symbols swirling around, then bomb, quick, say the mantra, then the images and the nectar start pouring. But mostly it's just the timing and the thoughts But mostly it's just the timing and trying to keep the images straight right now. Okay? So, yeah, when you're first learning the practice, it seems like, boy, there's so much, so many steps in here. Okay? First of all, nothing is swirling around. Yeah? Vajrasattva is just sitting on the crown of your head. Yeah? He's not swirling around. The mantra is not turning at his heart. You know? The mantra letters at his heart are standing still. If you're visualizing them turning, it can really turn your mind up, and don't do that. So the mantra letters are still, yeah? So nothing's swirling around. Just Vajrasattva is sitting there, and the light and nectar is pouring down from the mantra and going into you. Okay? Oh, that just reminded me to get back to the topic of mindfulness. You know how to practice mindfulness when you're doing this? When the nectar is coming into you, that's a way of being mindful of the body. Okay? It's a practice of the mindfulness of the body. Because you have this nectar coming in. And how is your body receiving the nectar? Are you fighting the nectar? Yeah? Are you not, is your mind not letting the nectar go to certain parts of your body? You know? And because as you feel the nectar coming in, you become very aware of the different sensations in your body, don't you? You become aware of where something is tight, where something's relaxed. You become aware of kind of how the emotional, whatever going on in you emotionally, can appear sometimes as images in your body or as feelings in your body. You know, has that happened to you? So it becomes also a practice of mindfulness of the body when the nectar's flowing through your body. Okay? The mindfulness of feelings. Okay? The second of the four mindfulness, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. When you're visualizing the light and nectar coming through, okay, are you having pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, neutral feelings? How do you react to pleasant feelings? How is the feeling of the nectar coming through different than other pleasant feelings you have, like when you eat ice cream? Okay? Or if you're having an unpleasant feeling in your body and the nectar's trying to go through, but you know, there's something unpleasant. Is that a physical unpleasantness? Is that something that's tied to an emotion that you're experiencing? How do you react to unpleasant feelings? Do you tighten up even more? Okay? So investigating your feelings while the nectar is flowing. Okay? Or if your mind is unhappy that day, how do you react to unhappy feelings in your mind? Or how do you react to happy feelings in your mind? Now, it's quite interesting. Because you can see, you can begin to see so clearly, as soon as there's an unhappy feeling, I don't know about your mind, but my mind just says, I reject this. This is totally unacceptable. You know? I have to do something to remove this unpleasant feeling ASAP. You know? So the mind jumps for whatever samsaric thing can remove it. Okay? Whether it's a restless unpleasantness in the mind or, you know, something going on in the body. So be mindful of the feelings. Okay? Be mindful of the thoughts while you're purifying. What kind of thoughts are coming up? What kind of emotions are coming up? Yeah? Learning to discriminate. What are positive emotions? What are negative ones? Where does your mind feel like it's really settled, and where is your mind kind of skipping over and rationalizing and justifying, and it's not really settled? Okay? And so this can happen when, you know, maybe something's come up for you to purify, and you can watch as you're purifying it. You're purifying and purifying, and you're also saying, yes, but this person did da 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 da. And so watch that. And what is that? Is that a positive mental factor? Is that a negative mental factor? Why is that one coming up? What's the logic of the mind in saying, yes, but I'm purifying, but it's really they did da-da-da-da-da. Okay? Okay. So be, you know, be mindful of your mind and the mental factors, you know, the thoughts and emotions. Okay. Be mindful of impermanence, how quickly your mind is changing. Be mindful of emptiness while you're doing this. Okay? So that this is just another way to bring mindfulness into your Vajrasattva practice. But it's the kind of way that, that you try and be aware when you're doing the visualization and the mantra. Okay? So nothing swirling around. The only thing that melts is at the very end, Vajrasattva melts into light and absorbs into you. Okay? And then you feel like your body's become completely clean, clear light crystal, and your mind has become like Buddha's mind. Yeah, and stay with that for a while. He commented about that he really wants to work on purifying his speech. Because when he's, if he's not swearing and telling people off, then everybody thinks that something's wrong with him. So he needs to, he really wants to change his speech and his self-image and I guess his image in front of other people. So I think that's quite laudable, quite praiseworthy. Okay. Oh, then he was saying, okay, and I think he may be fairly new to the Dharma. He says Buddha didn't have to take any vows and no one gave him any titles. There were no mantras or meditational deities for him to visualize, and he became Buddha. So why do we need to do all these things? How many of you have not thought the same thing? I understand. Mantras are a mind protection. Vows are to keep ourselves in line. Titles let us know previous accomplishments. Meditational deities are to focus our thoughts. In the end, though, Buddha had none of these, and he turned out perfect. Why don't we say? Why don't we say it under the why don't we say it under the Bodhi tree for 7 years? Okay. So first of all, to just clarify anything, when you said Buddha didn't take any vows, actually, the Buddha was the vows. His mind had no negativity, so his mind was already living in vows. He didn't need to take them. Okay? The rest of us, because our mind is not a living manifestation of the vows, need to take the vows. Okay? The Buddha was all, his mind was already the vows, so no need to take them. Okay? His second thing, titles let us know of previous accomplishments. False. Okay? Titles are words. They are labels. They don't denote anything. And especially when you're looking for spiritual teachers, do not rely on titles. Okay? And His Holiness tells the Tibetans again and again and again, don't look at somebody's titles, look at their practice. Okay? And especially here in America, titles are used every which way. The title Lama, for example, is totally ambiguous. You know, it used to mean, in the tradition how I was raised, that it was for a really greatly, you know, well-respected teacher. Then in other traditions, if you do a 3-year retreat, you get the title Lama. But now, even some people don't do a 3-year retreat. They give themselves the title Lama. Okay? Even getting the title for having done a 3-year retreat, His Holiness says, that's too easy. That's not actually, you know, beneficial. So the title Lama means almost nothing nowadays. Okay? You know, I have the title Venerable. Okay? Why that title? It was not my own doing. When I went to Singapore to live, the Singaporeans address all monks and nuns calling them venerable. That is their title, you know, how they address, showing respect to ordained people. And so that's how that came about. And in America, I think it's good if somebody's a monastic, that they're addressed by venerable or some kind of title, you know, Bhante or, you know, whatever it is, according to the tradition. But that's, that indicates that the person has taken precepts. It doesn't indicate any kind of level of realization. Although, to keep precepts, you definitely have to practice. Okay? Bhikshuni, that title I use sometimes, that's my level of ordination. That's it. Okay? Sometimes I've been in places where people try and call me Lama. I stop it right away. I would be embarrassed to death if any of my teachers ever heard that somebody was calling me Lama, because Lama is a title that's reserved for people with the capacity of my teachers. It's not reserved for people like me. Okay? However, in America, you have people who are not monastics, or people who know the Dharma 1 or 2 years, who have not done much study or not done much retreat, and they are called Lama. So the title does not mean very much. So do not determine your spiritual teachers by titles. Even if somebody's called Rinpoche, that title is given in all sorts of different ways now, too. Okay? And His Holiness says very clearly, some people just live off the achievements of their previous life. And He tells the incarnate lamas who are called Rinpoche, they need to practice this lifetime. Some of them are quite remarkable practitioners. Some of them, I don't know. You know, if somebody has the title Geshe, that's an educational degree. So there, at least, you know, somebody's put in the work and, you know, gotten that educational degree. But do not rely on titles. You really have to see how a person lives, okay? And how they teach, if their teachings accord with what the Buddha said or not. And if they keep precepts, you know, whatever level of precepts they have, if they keep that level of precepts well. Yeah. And there's the whole thing in the Long Men about the qualities to look for in a teacher. So do not do that according to titles. Okay? Then, next thing. Okay. So there were no mantras or meditational deities for him to visualize if he became a Buddha. Well, as the Buddha is portrayed in the Pali tradition, he didn't do mantras and visualization practices and things like this. You know, the Buddha, as portrayed in the sutras, he was doing basically the practice of the four mindfulnesses, the four foundations of mindfulness, which is an incredible practice, and meditating a lot on the 12 links of dependent origination, contemplating impermanence and dukkha, suffering, emptiness. So that's how the Buddha is portrayed, you know, as living when he appeared on this earth. Okay, that's to the common appearance. But at the same time the Buddha was living like that, he was also teaching a select group of students, which included some human beings, but also many bodhisattvas. He was teaching them things like the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which are on a whole different level. Okay, and he was also teaching the Tantra to some very, you know, highly realized disciples. So the rest of us, you know, anybody who were ordinary beings who were alive at that time, were not privy to those teachings because we didn't have the level of realization where those teachings would have benefited us. Okay? So, but those mantras and visualizations were given to those highly realized beings, so there became a lineage of tantric teachings. The Mahayana teachings were given to those bodhisattvas and to some human beings who were at that level. That continuation of those teachings, exists until that day, until this day. So the teachings have become more widely spread. But the Buddha himself actually practiced all these different things. They're not things that the Buddha didn't practice or that the Buddha didn't teach, because otherwise you would have other people who, you know, were less realized than the Buddha making up things that Buddhists practice, which is kind of absurd. Okay. So the Buddha did teach and practice all these things, although he didn't do it necessarily in the common appearance, in a very public way to everybody. Okay, so why do we do all these things? Because they're beneficial. Yeah. Now, having said that, the Buddha taught many, many different methods of meditation because people have many different types of dispositions and different types of tendencies. Okay? So for some people, the practice of, let's say, the four foundations of mindfulness as taught in the Pali Sutras, that way really appeals to them and it just fits their mind perfectly and they practice that and that's wonderful. Okay? For other people, the way the Buddha taught in the Mahayana Sutras and, you know, talking about all, you know, bodhicitta and, you know, giving up or postponing even your own enlightenment, if that were beneficial in order to benefit all sentient beings. So cultivating that deep wish to benefit all sentient beings, practicing the emptiness as taught in the Mahayana Sutras, all these kinds of things, for other people, that way of practice is very suitable. Okay, so they practice in that way. Now, and already in the Mahayana Sutras, if you read them, I mean, you know, there's pure lands, and, well, like the Sangata Sutra, you know, and beings are going here and there and emanating, and, I mean, it's pretty enormous, isn't it? Yeah? And so, for some people, this way of thinking about the enormity of the universe, the enormity of infinite sentient beings, okay, and pure lands and skies full of offerings and all this stuff, for some people that expansiveness, you know, just, and especially the bodhicitta, as Lama Zopa always says, I will attain enlightenment alone for the benefit of all these sentient beings. I will go to the hell realms alone in order to benefit each and every sentient being. You know, for some people, although these things seem rather intimidating and like, how can I ever, you know, do that? Just even thinking that way, you know, it like is so inspiring, you know? And some people say, okay, even like it's totally out of sight, how can I mean, I can't even endure the pain of, you know, my leg hurting. And here I am vowing to go to the hell realms for eons alone for the benefit of each and every sentient being. You know, even though this is totally inconceivable, still it's like so inspiring. One day I will want to be able to do that. Yeah? And so your heart just is like filled with joy just at the thought, one day, maybe, I'll be able to actually do that. You know, because it just seems like such an incredible, marvelous thing to be able to do. Even though we're not capable of it right now. You know, so that just really is like, I'm going there, you know. But for other people, it's like thinking about that. It's like, wait a minute, this is too much, you know. It's like, no, I just got to sit. Let's just watch my breath. You know. Feel my sensations in my body. You know, I can't go and think about those. So you see, everybody has really, really different different dispositions, different things that inspire them. So that's why the Buddha taught all these different methods, you know. And we see in this way how incredibly skillful the Buddha was, you know, as a teacher, that he could teach all these different things, you know, for all these infinite sentient beings who all, you know, have their own way of doing stuff. Yeah? So it really, I think it shows us how tremendously skillful as a teacher the Buddha was. Yeah. And it also teaches us how important it is never to criticize any of the Buddha's teachings or any of the practices. Okay? You can debate about levels of understanding of emptiness and things like that. Okay? But you never tell somebody, oh, that practice is wrong and what you're doing is wrong. Or, you know, I mean, how can you say anything the Buddha taught is wrong? Yeah. And if somebody is doing some kind of virtuous practice, we have to respect them. And even, well, I shouldn't say even, you know, if they're Christians or they're, you know, they're doing some other religious practice, if they're keeping some morality, we have to put our palms together and respect that they're keeping morality. You know, it's not our business to go around trashing other religions and tearing people away from the things that they have faith in. Okay, that's not helpful at all. Yeah. So, like I said, we can debate things, you know. If somebody wants to talk about can there be a creator God, yeah, we can, you know, talk about that and why we don't believe in a creator God, or, you know, or what our view of emptiness is if somebody has another view. And, you know, all these things you can discuss and debate, but that's very different than criticizing. You know, and that's very different from tearing somebody away from a practice that they're doing that is virtuous, even if what they're doing is incomplete. Don't make them lose faith, at least in the things that they're doing that is positive. You know, if you can enhance their mind and, you know, kind of drop seeds of bodhicitta. I mean, like when I went to Thailand, you know, before the airplane was landing, I was just making prayers, you know, may I bring bodhicitta here. So I was kind of, you know, this undercover agent. So, you know, just, you know, little things. I mean, I didn't push it on anybody, but when people ask questions, I talked about it, you know, because I love that. So, you know, but you never go and say, oh, well, you know, your tradition, blah, 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 your religion, blah, 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 blah. I mean, that's not our business to do. Yeah, whenever anybody does anything that is remotely constructive, we bow. Yeah. We bow to the deed that they're doing. That doesn't mean we have to approve of everything that they do in their whole life. Okay? George Bush makes one good decision, we can put our palms together, you know? So that helps us to really respect traditions and respect human beings.